Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. When a motocross accident left Bowie County, Texas native Chad McCrary without the use of his legs, his first reaction was despair. For this week's episode, I spoke with Chad about how he overcame that adversity to become a professional bodybuilder, motivational speaker, and author. He recently fulfilled a longtime dream when he competed in the Mr. Olympia contest, the world's premier bodybuilding event. It's an inspirational story that left me feeling anything is possible. Here's my conversation with Chad McCrary. Good morning. Thanks for joining me today. I'm really interested to hear your story.
Thank you for having me. I'm grateful. I appreciate it. It's an honor.
Sure. I definitely want to get into how you've gotten to where you are today, but I wanted to start. I'm just curious about what a typical day is like for you. Do you train every day?
Actually, no. In our society, you know, everybody teaches more is better. But in the gym, that's certainly not the case because you can overtrain. Because your muscles actually have to have adequate rest. That's when they grow. Okay. You know, in the gym, you're breaking them down. And provided you're eating enough protein, the muscles will repair themselves bigger and stronger slowly over a span of time. It's a very slow process, but that's essentially how it works in a nutshell. So now to answer your question, I work out on a Monday, Tuesday, usually rest on Wednesday. I work out Thursday, Friday, and then I will rest Saturday and Sunday. I think there's a misconception when a lot of people look at guys like myself or others, they think we live in a gym, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, that's definitely what I thought. So that's why I asked. Where do you work out?
I am at Fitness Pros over on Summerhill. It's right there behind the cleaners at Summerhill and College. It's a private training studio. So there's very few people that are in there, which I kind of enjoy because, you know, if I go to a normal public gym, you know, people want to talk a lot, and you know, that's fine and good, and it kind of comes with the territory. But at the end of the day, I'm there to get my workout in and make some progress, you know, because guys I compete against are very high caliber, and every rep, you know, counts. And it gets down to very minute details, and it is an actual science. It very much is,
and takes some concentration, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely, it takes a lot of concentration. It's just, sometimes it's overwhelming preparing for such a show because you just feel like it's almost like you're counting the breath of each day, you know. But I mean, not literally, but everything is so calculated. And then, you know, people just see the pictures and they're like, okay, yeah, that's awesome. But they don't see what goes on behind the scenes. And it's literally a 24/7 thing. I know my days are structured. I'm going to eat between 5 and 6 meals every single day. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get in that right macronutrient ratio of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. And, you know, that takes a lot of preparing. My days are very structured in a sense of around my eating and resting and how I take my nutritional supplements and when I take them. You know, it's a lot. It's a lot. But, you know, I love it. It's a labor of love. I don't, you know, it's something I've always enjoyed doing. So to me, it's not work. And it does give me structure. And I need the structure.
Besides the obvious, how do your workouts differ from someone who has full use of their legs? Do you have to use different equipment, different techniques, anything like that?
That's certainly a good question. The short answer to that is yes, I have had to change the way I work out because now everything I do has to either be sitting down or laying down. So there was a lot of improvising in the beginning because I was used to doing a lot of heavy compound movements on my feet. I can't do that anymore. So I've just had to get very creative, you know, and improvise, which my past line of work as a firefighter and a paramedic, you know, we had to learn how to improvise. So that really wasn't too much of a hurdle for me in that aspect. But yeah, really had to to do some modifications on how I do things.
I'm not super familiar with the bodybuilding world. What wins competitions? It's judged, correct?
It is a panel of judges, generally 5, 6, 7 judges. And they're judging one on your symmetry, your proportions, and your leanliness. And also with that, your posing.
Okay.
That scores points. You know, you get up front and in bodybuilding, there's nothing to do with weights on stage. You get up and you go through these mandatory poses of like a front double bicep.
Right.
And then,
so it's not like, it's not like powerlifting where you're actually lifting.
No, sir. Right. We get on stage and we line up side by side and they compare everybody. And you go through these comparisons of, you know, side chest, side tricep, you know, quarter turn to the right. And then we'll look at your back and then quarter turn to the right. And then we'll look at your right side and then back quarter turn to the right facing the judges. And in each one of those quarter turns, they ask you to hit certain poses. And what they're looking for, like I said, it's symmetry. They're looking for your proportion. How does your physique flow? Are you lean? You know, because if you get up there and you're just smooth and you can't see the cut, you're not going to score very well.
Okay, so it's a lot more than just bulk.
Oh, my word, yes. And then you have the whole effect of practicing your posing to get that, you know, to master the art of posing. And it is very much an art. And it's one that I'm still learning, you know, to make it look very graceful when you get up there and really show the anatomy of the body. And it's, to me, it's a beautiful thing. You know, when I look at other guys, other bodybuilders, and even the females in the fitness industry, you know, just displaying that work of art. You know how much hard work has went into it, you know. I love the sport, man. I always have.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Does your condition put any limits on what you're able to achieve? Do you have a lower ceiling than other people?
Well, if you would have asked me that prior to my injury, I would have said, yeah, interestingly, but after my injury, I was told I'd never walk again. I was told I'd never lift weights again. I was told I was never going to do a lot of things. So I try not to put a limit on what I can do. My mantra to people is, if you can believe it, you can achieve it. And it is very much a mindset. And it is, you can train your brain much like you train your muscles, to rewire that thinking into a new way of thinking. You change your thinking, because when we change the way we look at things, then the things that we look at start to change, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about perspective. And yes, if you really want to get right down to it, there is some things I can't do. But, you know, I focus more on what I can do rather than what I can't do. And I always like the word, you know, impossible. But when I see that word, I see it as I'm possible, not impossible. Mm-hmm. I'm possible. So that's another thing, you know, with my speaking and stuff, and I try to convey to people is, a lot of times we already have this preconceived idea of what we're capable of. And that ceiling is low in comparison to what you're really capable of.
Mm-hmm.
The human body is a very amazing thing, and it is so much more capable than we give it credit for. And I always tell people, you're never going to know what your body's limits are if you don't push it to its limits.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised how much higher, faster, further you can go when you harness that mindset that I'm going to do it.
What was your life like before your injury? Sounds like you were always a pretty athletic guy.
In high school, no. I was, believe it or not, I was about 6 foot tall and 160 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I played my freshman year, and I didn't even finish the season. I got tired of getting run over. I was just so skinny, and I was like, quite frankly, didn't like getting run over. And
you're talking about football?
Yes, sir. So, you know, then my senior year, I played left field in baseball, and I'll just be honest, I wasn't even good. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't always athletically inclined. So prior to that, you know, I just graduated from DCAB in 92 and worked a lot of construction work and stuff for 7 years. And then I just come to a point one day where I realized that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life, that I wanted to do something. I was already on the volunteer fire department over in DCAB, and I wanted to become a paramedic. And I set my sights on that. And I didn't know that I'd be able to pass it. And I tell this to a lot of people. They don't realize when I was in school, I was in special education. They told me I was slow. So my confidence out of high school wasn't very high at all. I just assumed I had sold myself a lie by telling myself that I wasn't that smart. I wasn't that capable. I'll just settle for construction, and that was fine. But much to my surprise, I wasn't slow. I just had a different learning curve. And when I finally got into the paramedic class, I just ate it up. I was like a sponge. And ironically, out of 30 of us, I graduated top of my class. So at that point, I realized, you know, I'm not slow. I'm capable of doing whatever. So after that, my confidence really started to soar. You know, I was working for LifeNet as a paramedic, and then it was just like, what can I not do? So I started just knocking down all these things that was originally in the back of my mind was virtually just, I was like, I can't do that, you know, it's going to be too hard. And then in 2000, I got hired at Red River as a firefighter and a paramedic, and they told me they were going to pay me to go to the gym because they wanted me to be in shape for my job. And I was like, this is my opportunity.
Yeah.
I can get paid to go to the gym. So I did. And that was in December of 2000. And I had no clue what I was doing. And I just remember the first workout. I was like, who in their right mind would love to do this? It was so excruciatingly painful.
That sounds like me at the gym.
But I hung in there. And I bulked up from 160 to a 240 pounds over 3 years. And then I cut it back down to 190, and I decided to do a show in Dallas. It was a novice show. You asked earlier, like, how does one win and get to where I'm at?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. The odds of turning pro as a bodybuilder about the odds of getting into the MLB or the NFL.
Right.
You have to do a novice show. You have to win a novice show. And then you advance to the open class. And each time, of course, the competition gets stiffer and stiffer and stiffer.
It sounds similar to golf, where you qualify and then eventually get on the pro tour. Is that roughly analogous?
Yes, yes. And then after you win an open class, then you have to get into a national qualifier. And each one of these, you don't just have to place first, but you have to win the overall between you, the middleweight, and the lightweight.
Oh, so, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a really long shot. And then once you get nationally qualified, you have to go to nationals, and you have to not only win your weight class, but you still have to win the overall before you can have a pro card. And I tried to get my pro card. I was nationally qualified in 2008, and it took me all the way till 2019 to get my pro card. I just hung in there. I kept getting runner up. And then in 2019, I was like, I'm going to give it one more go, you know. And luckily enough, I got it. And it was awesome. Like, all that work, all that commitment, the dedication, you know.
Did you ever feel like giving up?
It was, yeah. There's been a lot of times in my life I've felt like giving up. There's been a lot of times I've had a lot of failure where I just fell flat on my face, but I tell people, you know, that's part of the process. You're going to fail, but just make it a learning experience. I mean, I wanted to give up on life at one point. I seriously contemplated suicide.
Mm.
I was depressed. I could no longer be a paramedic, and I loved helping people, and it just didn't make sense to me. And I mean, I'm a Christian, and, you know, I just would ask God a lot of times, why would you take something away from somebody that love to help people? Didn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
But look back now and today, you know, God has put me in a position to help way more people than I ever could have from the back of that ambulance with the platform I have now. You know, it's helping people in a different way. I'm not starting IVs and shocking people and innovating on, you know, I'm reaching out to people you know, that need that inspiration, or they need to hear, you know, someone that's been there, been in the trenches, left for dead, and then above it all, still persevered.
Are you comfortable talking about your injury? What happened that day?
Yeah, 100%. So in 2003, there were 18 of us in the heavyweight. This was before my injury, 2 years before my injury. I placed ninth, and I realized right then and there that, you know, my enthusiasm far outweighed my genetic potential. So I was like, I'm not going to do the competing anymore. I'm just going to work out, and I'm going to do some things I always wanted to do. I wanted to get my pilot license, and I did that. And I never would have dreamed I could be able to do that, but I did. And then I always loved motocross, and some friends of mine around town were riding. So I was like, man, this is awesome. So I went and bought a YZ250 and started, you know, getting on the tracks and jumping some jumps. And I was hitting some pretty good jumps. And the day of the accident, which was March 27th of 2005, we were in Plain Dealing, Louisiana. And on this particular track, on the backside, they had a jump. It's 3 mounds. You could either single it, meaning jump the first two and then hop the last one. Mm-hmm. Or you could jump off the first one and try to clear the middle one and land on the third one. And the total length of the jump was about 120 feet, which is a long way.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So the first time I came around the corner, I didn't feel like my tire hooked up enough because there's a lot of loose dirt. So I did that a couple of times. And there comes a point when you start up the jump, you're 100% committed. You're locked in. There's no turning back after a certain point. So I come around the corner. I had it in second, and I grabbed third gear. And when I came off the face of the jump, I launched, and I could see the middle mound going beneath me. And then when I looked up, I could tell by my trajectory I was going to be short. Ooh. And I was like, this is all going to do my mind 30 miles a minute. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord. And it was fast. At the same time, it was almost like slow motion. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I can jump off. Because like 30 feet in the air, like I can surely break both legs, or I can see if the suspension will cushion me. And I chose to stay on the bike. But when I did, I was so short, I did what they call casing the jump. My front tire and back tire straddled the apex. It landed right on the frame. And all that energy caused me to go down on the seat with my butt, and then all that energy just transferred up my spine. I heard it pop. And the strangest thing of it all was when it popped, there was this enormously bright light that flashed over my eyes. I'm really not sure what that was. It was just bizarre, but I still had enough inertia. You know, it catapulted me off the back, kind of like a cartwheel, ragdoll sort of thing. And about another 10, 15 feet, and I landed face down, slid to a stop, and everything was just quiet. And I could hear my heart beating, and I thought that was it, you know, so I started to pray.
So you were conscious the whole time?
I was conscious the whole time. I never lost consciousness, but I was face down in the dirt with my helmet, and everything was black. So I couldn't see anything, but I could hear people around me. I could hear familiar voices.
And I'm sure your training as a paramedic gave you a particular kind of awareness of what was happening that you might not have had otherwise, right?
You're absolutely correct. The fact that I heard the pop, and then when I tried to get up, my legs wouldn't respond. So I knew, like you said, as being a paramedic, I knew I broke my back, and I also knew that I had compromised my neurological status because my legs wouldn't respond.
All the latest news and more is always right at hand with the Texarkana Gazette mobile app. Updates and breaking news alerts throughout the day keep you up to speed on everything happening in Texarkana and beyond. There's even a daily digital replica of our print edition. All the features you love, like puzzles and our special sections, are right there. It's like having the whole paper in your pocket or purse. Best of all, it's free to download. Look for the Texarkana Gazette app in Google Play or the Apple App Store today.
I only felt like I existed from the waist up. It was weird.
Wow, that's terrifying. So what was it like right after that? How much did you struggle to adapt just in the immediate aftermath?
Well, I was airlifted to LSU. Uh-huh. And the doctors kept thinking maybe I had what they call a stinger. Right. Football players get it, you know, just a sudden jolt to the spinal cord to cause temporary paralysis. But in my mind, I knew it was more than that. Mm-hmm. And just my training and my gut feeling. So they ran me through a series of MRIs and x-rays just to confirm my suspicions. It was a T12 burst fracture. And they had to wait a week for the swelling to go down. And so I just laid there, you know, I was thinking about my new wife, my marriage, my career as a firefighter and a paramedic, and how, you know, I was thinking it could be over. It probably is over. It was so overwhelming. I think my brain kind of shut down from all the trauma, just such a life-changing event. And they did the surgery a week later, a 10-hour surgery, and the surgeon told me after the surgery they picked out 142 pieces of just that T12 vertebrae.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it exploded. But the bad thing is, you know, your spinal cord runs through your vertebrae. Mm-hmm. And then in the typical adult, about 36 inches long from the base of the brain. And at the T12 level where it snapped, it also tore my spinal cord about 95% in two.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was the most painful surgery. And I laid there for 7-8 days and just had roll up a wash rag. And I just put it in my mouth and bit on it, you know, even with the pain meds. You just couldn't control it. It was unfathomable. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And the neurologist came in there. She had two other neurologists with her. And, you know, they're very to the point, and they should be, you know. You don't want to. We were always told as a paramedic, be straight up front with people so that they understand what you're saying.
Right.
So she comes in, and she looked at me, and she introduced her two colleagues to me and said, you know, we don't think you're ever going to walk again. And I heard what she said, but I made her repeat it. And I heard it, but I wasn't trying to digest it. It was like the whole world just went numb at that point, you know, to tell me that. And that was hard, you know, it was very hard. So I stayed there for a couple of weeks, and then they shipped me back up here to St. Michael Rehab for 92 days. I didn't get to come home for like 100 days.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So came back home, was in the wheelchair, couldn't walk. Just trying to figure things out, you know. It was so crazy. And I remember one day I was just praying, you know, to God. There's a lot of uncertainties. And for whatever reason, it's just all of a sudden there was a peace that came over me that I knew no matter what, that everything would work out and it would be fine. So they put me in dispatch for 2 years. I knew my career was over. They never told me that. I knew. Mm-hmm. And I worked for the government, you know, so they were willing to accommodate me because I could have went out on full disability. I still could, but mm-hmm. If I can get up and go to work, I'd rather get up and go to work. I don't want to draw disability. So I went to the legal office and spent 10 years there in the headquarters building. And now I'm downstairs in procurement and solicitations in the business office.
So was there one moment, one turning point where your perspective changed?
Yeah, there was a couple of pivotal moments. One that I can think of right off the top of my head that sticks out to me is I was featured in Four States Living magazine and I was on the cover, and you know, I didn't think a lot about it. It was just kind of brief coverage of me and my story. And I was in Walmart one day, and this lady I didn't know, you know, she stopped me and said, She said, I don't mean to bother you. I said, you're not bothering me. She said, I just wanted to tell you something. She said, are you the young man that was on the cover of Full Face Magazine? I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, I just wanted to tell you that my daughter was going through a really rough patch. She went through a divorce. She was struggling with alcoholism. And she was contemplating killing herself. And she said, she picked up that article and read that about you. And she said, I want you to know that she has gotten on with her life. And I just remember that point. I didn't know what to say. I just distinctly remember getting goosebumps all over me and like the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I still don't know what I told that lady. I wasn't prepared to hear something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just said amen or something to that effect. So after that, I realized how much I had significantly underestimated the power of my testimony to touch other people. But to me, it wasn't a big deal. I've lived it. So to hear that, it was like, wow, that's powerful. And then I began to just kind of tell my story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember I had this feeling. See, I kind of did a little bartering or bargaining with God at one point. I told him, I said, you know, if you'll make me walk again, I will carry your story. I'll carry your word. And after 3 long years of trying everything I knew to try to get out of that chair, because, see, I still had 5% to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to where I could stand for like 5 seconds. And I could hold on to like the bar in the living room. Then I could stand 10 minutes. I could stand 15 minutes. Then I got a walker, and I could go 5 feet. Then I could go 10 feet. And this is all, you know, over months and months and months and months and months. But I was just relentless and determined that I wasn't going to be bound to that wheelchair the rest of my life. And I can today. I can stand up, and I can walk short distances. I don't like to. I do it, but it can be dangerous because the walk is very lame, and I could fall and hurt something or hurt more, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
Still, that's nothing short of a miracle. So, you know, I'm sitting around and I just felt this overwhelming feeling, and I knew what it was, but I wasn't trying to hear it. I told God, it's like you got the wrong person. It's just, I can't be up in front of a crowd of people like that, you know. And I didn't feel qualified, to be quite frankly honest, until I spoke with another gentleman one day that told me something that really stuck out to me. I told him how I felt. He took off his glasses. You know, he was real serious at that point. And he said, I want to tell you something. He said, you know, he said, God doesn't always call the most qualified. He said, he qualifies those he calls.
Mm.
And man, that stuck. I took that home and I chewed on it and I slept on it. And I was like, all right, God, all right, I'll do it. So I created this website and all these brochures and nothing happened. I was like, you got to be kidding me. You've been hounding me for 3 years on this, you know. And then the Bowie County Western Bowie County Rotary Club asked me to speak. I think it was like 10 people. I was so diggum nervous. I mean, my mouth was dry. And I was sweating profusely. I don't even know what I said.
Mm-hmm.
I was so uptight about it. But they liked it, you know. And then my school that I graduated from, DECAB, asked me to speak to the school. So this was like 600 people. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the last speaking I did was in Tyler, Texas, so like 1,100 students. So, yeah. I guess I've always said God calls you to it. He'll see you through it, you know, and he will equip you with the proper tools that you need. And I never prepare a speech. I'll spend some time in silence and pray. And I get up there and just let it out, you know. I find people like that better than. Nobody wants to see you reading off the sheet of paper.
Right. You have a book too, correct?
I do. I published a book in 2017. It is called Answering the Call, and it's on Amazon. And I thought the name for it would be really good because as a paramedic, I had to answer a lot of calls. But when I felt the calling to be a voice and to speak, I didn't want to answer that call, but I did anyway. So I thought that was fitting for the title.
I'll be sure and put a link to your website in the description for this episode so people can find you.
Definitely. And the thing is with the book, you know, I've always been the kind of person, I want to give back. And I work closely with the Dan and Christopher Reeve Foundation, you know, which Superman is near and dear to me because, you know, in my day it was Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, me too.
And, you know, again, he had that superhero look. I loved that. And who didn't like Christopher? You know, he had so much charisma, you know, and so much momentum. And he was a heck of an actor. And then for something catastrophic like that to happen to him, that really hit home with me, you know. And, you know, as you know, he and his wife, which they're dead and gone now, but his son, who looks just like Christopher, oversees it, and it's called the Dan and Christopher Reeve Foundation, and it's for spinal cord injury research. So a portion of the proceeds from all of my books go to that organization.
That's wonderful. And you're still competing. Just in October, was it, that you were in the Olympia contest, which I gather was a long-term goal for you?
Man, I never dreamed I'd be on that stage. When I was a kid, I remember seeing, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lou Ferrigno and all those guys, you know, on the Mr. Olympia stage. It started back in 1965, and before that, it was the Mr. America and the Mr. Universe. And, you know, it seemed like, it's almost like, I don't know how to compare it, but when I look back at it, it was such a far goal. I was like, you know, man, I'm never going to be there to that point. It's just, I admire it. I love it, but let's be real.
And put this in perspective for people. This is the tip top competition, correct?
It is. You know, you have not only do after once you turn professional, but you have to earn, you have to place in the top five of the pro show to even be able to get to do the Mr. Olympia. Mm. My first pro show was in June at the Europa in Dallas, and I got second place, and that qualified me for the Olympia. So the Olympia is the Super Bowl of bodybuilding, like football. Mm-hmm. It is only the best of the best. And there were eight of us in the wheelchair division. And literally, this is not a Texas thing. It's not a United States thing. It's worldwide. Mm. So there were eight of us spread out from Italy, Nigeria, the U.S., even Czech Republic, you know, of course, I was representing the United States. And out of eight, I got six. And for me, I thought that was a pretty respectable placing for the first Mr. Olympia, because I'm competing with the best in the world. Yeah. And I beat out
sixth, you know, best in the world is not bad.
Yeah, technically, I set at number six in the world. So, but currently, I'm training for the Arnold Schwarzenegger Classic.
Where will that be?
And that'll be in Columbus, Ohio. That's where it's always at. And it's okay. His show.
Okay.
It's his show. He will be there.
Have you ever met him before?
I have, and I'm looking forward to. I haven't had a chance to interact with him, but at this show, he will be there, and he'll be interacting with all the athletes. He comes around, and he tells you, you know, you tell him, he talks to you, and you get a picture with him. So it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And I've always couldn't wait to the day that I could have a little conversation with Arnold, you know, because he's the golden boy. He kind of set the tone back in the day, and there's no telling how many Muscle magazine covers, you know, he's graced over the years. And, you know, I didn't ever want to follow him with Arnold the politician. You know, I didn't get into that. I just wanted to know him as Arnold the bodybuilder, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's two big shows in wheelchair or in bodybuilding. That's the Olympia, which is the biggest. And then the Arnold is probably the second biggest show. And it's invitation only. And I got an invite. So, man, you got to go, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what's it been like meeting and interacting with some of the other wheelchair athletes that you compete against?
I love it, man. It's, we're different than a lot of the able-bodied people because I guess we're so few. And not only that, but we've all been humbled because we've been served up some slice of the humble pie, you know, what all we've all been through. So we're very close. I mean, yeah, we're there to compete against each other, but it's more of a brotherhood. You know, we're backstage cutting up and having a good time. And I like meeting all the other athletes as well because, you know, they also have interesting stories. Like I can't inspire myself.
Right.
So I look to others for that. And I get that from, you know, my fellow competitors that are in my weight class. You know, we share stories and all that, you know, how they all got injured, what their injuries were, et cetera. And it's just, man, it's been an amazing ride. I've had the opportunity to meet so many people, go so many places and hear so many other people's stories. It's just, I wouldn't change anything. I have no regrets in terms of how this has all unfolded. And it's really funny at the Olympia. I was right up front, you know, after we went out, then they had the main event. And I was sitting there and I looked over to my right and Dave Bautista was sitting right there.
Oh, wow. former professional wrestler for people.
Yeah. And he does, now he's doing a lot of movies. I think he's doing The Guardian of the Galaxy.
Right, right.
And I went over there, you know, he's like two seats over. I said, Dave Bautista, I said, are you doing? He's real soft spoken. I said, dude, can I get a picture with you? He's like, absolutely. And his bodyguard was with him. Bodyguard's like 354 pounds. He's a big dude. You know, Dave's not small.
Yeah.
So he takes the picture, but the lights are so bright in the background. When I got back over to my seat, I was like, oh, that's a crappy picture. I'm like, it's Dave Bautista. I got to get a good picture. So I went back there and I said, dude, listen, I know I'm not trying to bother you. I'm sorry. And I showed him the picture and he's like, yeah, that sucks. He's like, let's get another one.
That's great.
That was cool.
Well, thanks so much for taking a little time to share your story with us. I'm inspired and I hope people who hear this will be inspired as well. And like I said, I'll be sure and link to your website so people can take a closer look at your story, maybe reach out to you if they're looking for a speaker and just follow your career. We'll be looking forward to seeing how you do in Columbus.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. If I could leave the listeners with some final words.
Absolutely. You know,
if you can believe it, you can achieve it. You know, there's nothing that's extraordinary about me. I'm an example of if you put your mind to something and you say you're going to do it, you know, you can do it. It's just a matter of how bad do you want it? What sacrifices are you willing to make to go get whatever it is that you want? You know, we don't get what we wish for. We get what we work for. I can't emphasize that enough to people, especially young people. Opportunity is not going to come kick your door down. Opportunity is not going to come hop in your lap. You got to go kick some doors down. You got to make things happen. And I always tell people, you know, it's just baby steps every day, but that's getting you one step closer to whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish, whether that's a college education or in a particular career or whatever you're looking to do. And that's the approach that you have to take. You know, it's just, if you fall down seven times, get up eight times. It's just be relentless in your pursuit. Being resilient and persistent and determined will win the race every single time.
Thanks so much for those wise words. And again, thanks for taking a little time to talk to us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. It's just an absolute honor.
Sure. Take care. On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. The show was written, produced, and edited by Carl Richter. News stories are based on Gazette staff reports. Texarkana Gazette podcasts are made possible in part by a grant from the Google News Initiative Journalism Emergency Relief Fund. I'll see you next week on the line.